Hello, everyone. Let's say our opening prayer. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Beloved David,
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Peace, bliss.
Amen.
We'll do a short. Meditation. This has a little meditation by Mother, little comments by Mother from this last talk we've heard last Sunday. Quite powerful. And some music.
We remember what the Christ said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And so it is. I was thinking the other day of this beautiful song which has been written. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? And I thought of Jesus the Savior within myself and all that that wonderful Spirit who was within me, was God within me, had to go through in order to save this human self from sin for all time, so that the end of the world would come. And I thought of him as I saw him on the cross, and I wondered whether that was Jesus the Christ about whom I read in the Bible, about whom all men speak, or I wondered if it was my own Christ, that Christ which was within every man. And my love for him was so great that I would have done anything for him. This is divine love, and it was wonderful to feel that way, because for the first time I felt that love again. For the first time I could cry for him and for all of his children. I had cried before, but I saw at that time that I had been crying for myself and not for him. And then I wanted to die. I wanted to die all the way.
Kate, if you would start reading on chapter one when you get it, whenever you want to start. Kate, you're muted. You're still muted. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, sorry. This is the little quote before the chapter. He became one that was to be the guiding light of not only thousands, but of millions. And it is through his grace, through his teachings, through the things that he taught me, the techniques, that I went the way, and therefore I can tell you about the way. Chapter 1, The Master's Disciple. I meet my guru. I came to show you the way. I went the way myself because a very great master came into my life and he taught me the way. He expanded my consciousness. He expanded my heart. And he put a desire for God within me so strongly that it became a conflagration and it burned and it burned and it burned. And as I went on, I went through many, many things in my lifetime. The master with whom I studied came with a great mission in life. His name was Paramahansa Yogananda. He was a man from India who came here in 1920 as a delegate to the Religious Congress. The first time I ever laid my eyes on him, he walked out onto the platform of this tremendous big auditorium, those beautiful luminous eyes filled with the Spirit of God, his hair hanging down, very Christ-like face, and Christ-like in every part of his being and appearance. Then he opened his mouth and he started to speak. From 8 o'clock until 11, I sat absolutely spellbound, listening to this man of God from India explain to me the truth about the Christ worshipped by the Christians in the West. And for the first time in my life, he really made me realize that Christ was within myself, equally present everywhere, in every single human being, in every atom of space, every bit of consciousness, that he was, in truth, the Son of God, the only begotten Son, but that he had come from the Father and the Mother God and had taken on every form in the universe. I learned more about Christianity from my Hindu guru than I have ever learned in all the years of going to an Orthodox church. That the words that Jesus spoke were absolutely the truth, and they applied to me as well as to him. That they applied to every man, woman, and child in this whole universe. That God was within me. It was this temple that held the living God. He made me know that, as Christ taught, the kingdom of heaven was to be found within myself, as was my union with the Christ. And he gave me a dream, a vision. He told me that I could reach out for that dream and that vision, and if I did so, that I could find perfection within myself. I could find the light of God within myself. I could hear his voice. I could feel him. I could become one with him. And because of the words that he spoke, he so inspired me that he changed my whole life. When we are ready, then God sends us to a guru to open the eyes of our understanding. And as this one who has had union with God crosses our path and enters our life, every single thing in our lives is changed. There is an inner awareness, an upliftment, a feeling of exaltation, of mysticism that never existed before. We are lifted up into a world that we never knew. We are no longer conscious of this world as it was, but we have a new existence, a new life, a new birth in Christ, as it were. Many times the guru says many things, and in the beginning we take these things literally because we do not understand the inner meaning. But sometimes, years after, this thing which he gave us at that time clarifies itself, and because of some incident in our lives, or because of our own spiritual development and understanding, it takes on a completely different meaning. A completely different pattern. Would you like me to stop there, Larry, or keep going? a little bit more.
Yeah, if you think that, that's fine. That's a couple pages in, isn't it?
We can go on in a little bit if you like.
Go ahead.
I remember so well that this happened to me all of the years that I was with Master. I would go down there, meaning Mount Washington, and he would speak to me. I would listen to him as though nothing in this world existed except just the two of us there. It was as though time and space fell off and left us God alone. As he said these things, I later tried to apply them to my life and to my understanding at that time. And as my understanding was, as my consciousness was, I used them. For hours and hours and hours, I would sit at his feet and listen to the words of wisdom and of the Spirit, which poured forth from him. And as he spoke to me, my love for God grew, my desire for oneness with him. My yearning for him grew until there was nothing else for me but this one desire. I was willing to do anything and everything if I could only attain that oneness, if I could only come face to face with the vision of divinity within myself. He would fill me so full of the Spirit of God that it seemed as though I couldn't hold another thing. I came away from there just saturated with the bliss and the ecstasy with which he filled my being. Then I would leave him and I would be gone for a while, because I had to go out into the world again and digest the food which he had given me. And when I had digested it fully, then somehow God would always arrange for me to return and get some more. I've seen him 12 times in my life. And by that I mean sometimes I'd go down there and be down there for a week or two. But 12 separate times in my life is all I've ever seen him. I was so busy with the experiences of my life, which were so tremendous at that time, that I couldn't sit in meditation. But my whole life was meditation. My love for my guru and for God in him and the God that he taught me to know was inside of myself. It was so great that always I was meditating upon him, no matter what I was doing. Whether I was getting a meal or scrubbing a floor or washing diapers or whatever it was, God was there. And my guru was alongside of me. That romance was there, that eternal bondage of the soul, of binding together.
That's good. You know, I think that it must have been so interesting for Mother in those days to hear someone speak not only just the power and the Shakti of being with a great master, would no matter what he spoke about, would have been incredible. But for her, that was her first experience being around someone like him. And then he was talking about Christianity, about the deeper meanings, the deeper teachings. I just can't imagine what it was like. It almost like she had entered another world. Here's this person speaking with such authority about things that we think we know all about as Christians. And then connecting it to the Eastern teachings and connecting it to India. It'd be interesting to know if someone transcribed these talks that he gave. It'd be interesting to have them. I know that we talk about Catherine Coleman, and there are people with great spiritual power coming from them. So it isn't like it's completely unknown, and there are many saints historically. But you think about Mother in 1925, 17 years old, and 20 some years old. So, and she having lived a normal life out here in the West, wasn't like there was a bunch of sophisticated educators you could read, but you really didn't have a chance to see something like this. And here was someone coming and traveling. Of course, people traveled a lot in those days. Great speakers did. They traveled all over the country. Churchill used to come to America and enjoy traveling all over. because he was so welcomed. So it wasn't that unusual, but I think what Master brought, that was unusual. It wasn't the same thing as Catherine Coleman and the ecstatics and the charismatics, who focus so much on the power coming through their body and focus so much on curing and changing people and altar calls. Master and the teachings that we are involved with are much more subtle. They're told to souls that have been through this many times. We have the notion of reincarnation. It isn't that we have more, we gives us more patience, it might, but it certainly gives you the perspective of this being something you don't push and you don't instill some into someone from without. It's evoking these things from within the soul and slowly waking the soul up, bringing it out of the sleep, the trance state that we all live in each day. And this is what a great master can do. He was something else. He stayed here with us all these years too. All those many years, 30 some years. And completed his tasks. I'd love to know too what Master thought of Mother in those days. How did he assess her? She wasn't close to him. She wasn't part of the inner circle at all. But at the end of his life, he raised her up, trying to draw attention to her from within the organization, maybe, but trying to awaken her, knowing that she could pull off what was required without the help of the organization, that this was a soul who was waiting and coming, had come for this reason alone. We're so lucky to be part of this circle of friends that adore this man. Who understand him to the extent we can. Want to know more about his individual aspects of his life. But we know what he's done already. I remember what Peggy Dietz said in the interviews that were given, or she gave us a small talk at down in Ananda Village. Trying to think when that was. Anyway, she said that that was our joy. That was our only focus, was to make Master happy. That was our joy.
We recently had somebody order a book, order the Mystical Crucifixion and Mother's Centenary video, and mailed it down to her. And there was an occasion that she had to write back. The video didn't work, so we exchanged a few emails, and I asked her how she heard of it. Did she hear of it through the website? And she said, I'm an SRF devotee, and I'd never heard of Mother, and so I just wanted to find out more about her. And this week I was doing something and just wishing there was a picture of Mother and Master, just wishing there was one. And it made me think, though, that as the older generation dies off, and there are people who are devotees of SRF who want to find out these things, will some old material be discovered? Like, will we be able to hear maybe they've got it, the first talk, or the talk that Master gave in 1925. You know, I don't know if we have access to that, but something like that. And will they then uncover some letters like that Master wrote to people and mentioned Mother, or other pictures? Right.
And other pictures too, yeah. But yeah,
that both. Would be very exciting, yeah. to find that material.
Why don't you read a little bit more then, Kate?
Could have been like we didn't get very many pictures with Mother.
Yeah.
And it could have been like that with Master, that people didn't want to, you know, say, oh, can I get a picture with you? That maybe just wasn't done very much. And that's why we don't have them. I will never forget when his autobiography came out. My love for him was so tremendous. When you're at one with the guru, truly at one, in the true guru-disciple relationship, there's a hunger inside of yourself to know everything about them, to know what their life was in the human sense, and how gradually, through all of the things which are accomplished and gone through, how they attained their divinity. And naturally, I was one of those. So when I got my hands on this book, I just couldn't leave it alone. I was coming home on the plane, and I just sat there and read the whole thing. And then I just felt so terrible to think it had ended. I wanted more and more and more. It's something that was never ending. The true guru-disciple relationship is something which should be recognized by every disciple who has finally come to the point where they are ready to accept not only a minister, a priest, a spiritual teacher, but the one who is sent to them by God himself. It is said that the guru is God, or God himself, who takes human form at the time the disciple is ready and comes to earth to take that one and many others like him back to the Father. I am here because of the power of God in him. He saved my life not once, but many, many times. And the fact that I have been through all that I have been physically, the fact that I have been paralyzed twice, the fact that I have had 22 operations, the fact that I went through all that is described in the New Testament of the crucifixion, the mystical crucifixion, before many witnesses in India. I came through all of this and much, much more. I've been cold. I've been hungry. I've been without but one set of clothes for my body. I've done without. And because of the fact that I love God and my guru, that I was loyal to him, that I remained true to him in spite of everything that was put upon me and asked of me, or that I had to go through, has brought me to this moment. Whatever that is, only God knows. But I know this, that without my guru, I could not speak the truth to you, because it was through his love, through the truth which he taught me, through the methods which he gave me, through his own exemplary life, that I was inspired to find God within myself. I many times think of how beautifully this master from India taught about the Christ. He combined the teachings of the East and the West, and he showed that they were not different, that the universal Christ dwells in the heart of every man. People in all walks of life used the scriptures, whether it be the Christian scriptures or any other type of scriptures, and they look at these things literally in the beginning, because this is the only way they understand them. They take it that everything that was given there is actually a matter of history, outer history. They do not see the inner truth. But when the guru comes along, he who comes to bring you out of the darkness into the light, then the light shines in your vision and you see something there that you didn't see before. You become aware of something that you didn't know before, and you see the whole thing in a completely different perspective. This is the power of the guru, of the master, to give you God to give you understanding. Once somebody said that they'd gotten that the body was made in the form of a cross. A master was sitting at a table, and he took a fork, and he made the cross. And then he made the figure of the man on that cross, and he said, "That is Jesus, the Son of Man, the human ego, and we must go through the crucifixion in order to become the Christed One, the Son of God, to really realize who he was." This man from India made that statement, that tremendously true statement about the Christ in every man. So he had it all, but he couldn't teach it in the beginning because this was a totally Orthodox Christian world and they would not have accepted it. I'm not teaching you what I read out of a book. I'm not teaching you what somebody else told me that I listened to in a sermon, because you will find none of the things, or not very many of them, even in the master's lessons. He didn't give me the intimate details as I'm giving them to you, but he gave me the ways and the means to attain the knowledge of this truth. He gave me methods, a few simple techniques by which I could go inside the sanctuary of my own soul, my own temple, and find God there. He couldn't do it for me. He helped me all he could, but I had to do it myself. I had to be willing to pay the supreme price. I had to come to the moment when my love for God was greater than my love for myself, for my human self. It was greater than my fear of death. It was so great that I said to him, "Here am I, Lord, take me. Do with me as you will." And he did. He did in great measure. And I'm so grateful to him in spite of what this body has been through. I remember one time I had a long conversation with Master. It was as though, knowing how much I loved him, that he could just relax and not have to constantly wear the cloak of formality that he had to wear in most cases. So he took off his shoes and he lay down on the davenport and propped his head up on his elbow, and we literally gossiped for hours, just gossiped. In the things that he said to me, he unfolded tremendous things for the future. I didn't understand in entirety all of the things that he was trying to tell me. But I remember so well telling him that the things of the world had no longer any appeal for me, and that I wanted only God alone. I remember that evening that he showed me the spiritual eye, and he gave me the power of the Holy Ghost. As he took my hands in his, he looked into my eyes, and the power that came from his eyes was so penetrating that it was just like a white mist between us. His body disappeared, and I felt only this tremendous power, and saw only this great light. As I stood up to leave, all of a sudden he took me in his arms and he kissed me on the forehead. It was the first time he'd ever done this, and I was so filled with the ecstasy of God coming from this great God-man that I could scarcely stand on my feet. I walked to the door like a drunken person. All of a sudden he said, "Mildred." I turned and looked at him, and he said, "I just wanted to see you and look at you once more." And that was the last time I ever saw him that way, because then, right after that, he started putting me through tests. And these tests were terrific for the next 3 years, just terrific. While he never said a word to me, he put me through, inwardly, such tests, such experiences as you wouldn't believe. But you see, my love for God was greater than my love for myself. My love for my guru stood out above my love for anybody or anything, because I knew that he alone was the bridge between myself and the infinite, that without him I could go no place, do nothing, because I knew that he knew God and that he could help me to that ultimate end. After his passing, I went to India, not to go to another guru, to another master, but to get help for the work that my own guru had done. I went to India to get help, and the way that I got help was to be put through the crucifixion myself, so that I might become one with that great truth which Master taught us. I became that truth, so that no matter if all the books in the world, all of his lessons, all of his writings, all of the things he came to give are disposed of, are taken away, torn away, still I am that which he came to take me to. I am that truth. I have that truth within myself, and nobody can keep me from giving that truth to all I meet. and that is what must happen to each and every one of you. You must become that truth within yourselves. Master took me a tremendous way. He is always and forever my guru. Make no mistake about that. In this lifetime, and perhaps for all of the rest of the lifetimes. But I was directed to go to Ram Dass. I went through the crucifixion under him. And that's the end of chapter one.
Yeah, that ties in so nicely with the next chapter. And then explains the reason for this book. You know, it's so obvious the way that Mother expresses herself that she's a regular American woman. Caught up in a tremendous movement of spirit that Master brought and represented. And many, many souls in India and other forces of God involved in that. Many angels involved. Because this was a movement of spirit that will have repercussions throughout history. We don't know what part this particular thread that Master brings will be in the future, but it will be part of it. And we're very lucky to be so associated with it, and that it is really of the highest teachings. And there are others who teach at this level too. But we're very lucky to be associated with Yogananda and Mother and David. His foundation in faith that Master gave to Mother, that imparted to her, she couldn't have done it in one lifetime without his help. And of course he did many other things. But for Mother's needs and for her destiny, he gave her the foundation upon which she could stand. The human being is a slender stalk, seemingly, but it's bolstered by so much that its strength is not known. Hanuman has to be reminded of the powers that he has, and this is what we all have to find within ourselves. This great strength of God within us. And not rely on the human, but rely on the stronger, more tested strength of the force of God, of the structure that God gives us to stand upon.
More enduring.
Mother talked a lot about, maybe she didn't talk about as much as David talked about her, about being the householder. Mother certainly talked about, I have been through just about everything every one of you have been through. But it just made me think, in reading this chapter, about if she'd been one of those gone down to Mount Washington. She hadn't gotten married that first time, and very likely would have become a renunciate and a nun. And how different the trajectory of her life would have been, and would she have grown into the guru as we knew her? And would she have influenced the householder world in the same kind of way? And so difficult to know. I mean, it didn't happen, so that's, there it is. But it really made me just think of all that she went through in terms of the human life. You know, not only all the family, but the poverty. And it is interesting, if we think of her coming in as an avatar, to then have to go through all that, that seems karma, 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 which it isn't. It's just all for us and for an example for us. And like, she took on the sins of the world, like Jesus, of course, taking on the sins of the world and the weight of the world.
Can you talk about Mother's avatar and where that did Mother talk about that, or was that the people identifying her in India, or
David, I think a lot.
Well, Mother said it though. She taught that. She even taught the distinction between the word avatar and avataram, so that there is a notion of God descending to the earth in all his glory, and that's an avatar. And Krishna is probably the only one who fits that description the best, because he really was completely and always aware of who he was, even as a baby.
Right.
But all the ones that we know about other than that, maybe not Rama. Rama was so great. We just don't know. And the stories we just told about him, we don't know what he was really like. But she described this as being a person who had no karma of her own. But it's funny to think, because each one of us fits into that category too, we don't know what is ours and what is not, and we probably would be better off not knowing. So when Mother talks that way, I think more about it being, you know, Meher Baba talked as though he was the great one all the time. And I know, because God showed me with him early on, that he was speaking for us, that his statements that he was making were not identified with that small body of his. Mm. But he was teaching us how to speak. But he wasn't speaking to the human in us. He was speaking to the soul. So one of the things we feel is great safety when someone comes and says, you know, I'm the avatar, or, you know, I'm your satguru, I'm your guru. These things are really great, great gifts that are given, because they give such tremendous protection and safety.
And surety.
And yeah.
I think, though, to answer your question, that, I mean, from my recollection, Jill, and readings, Mother would say what others had said about her, and she did do the distinction, but she didn't stand up there and say, I am an avatar.
Well, I mean, she did say that. She did say she did talk about it from other people mostly, after traveling in India and things like that sort. But she did say explicitly that that was the case in her case.
But you don't remember her actually saying, I am an avataram. It was, she talked.
I'm saying that she wasn't comparing it to something else someone else was saying, nor was she comparing it to someone else's own experience. She was stating it. I don't remember the words that she used. I am an avatar. It's not important. But mm-hmm. she was saying that was her experience. She had, God told her she had had no karma of her own before this lifetime.
I tried to research that term avatarum, but I couldn't find any reference to it.
Oh. Anyway. Interesting.
So the difference is whether it's veiled or known? Is that the distinction?
The clearest indication is complete realization from birth. And maybe Ananda Moya Ma fits that too. But is avatara. An avataram. This was something she was told in India. The terminology was not her own.
So it might be, Bob, it might be a Sanskrit word or something that we're not, that's difficult for you to spell based on how we say it.
Right.
And also, we don't know who she was talking to, some great master that wasn't, a lot of these higher teachings in India aren't on the internet, you know, they're just not. And we have so much faith in the internet, and there is a lot of great stuff. Yeah. But there is a lot on the internet that's really high. There's no denying that there's a lot of great masters using it the way that it's the proper use of it, the good use of it. But of course,
Sunyata, that friend of Ananda Maimaz, it might be another one.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
I gave you that book about him.
Oh yeah, it's sitting on my dresser over there. Yeah, I forgot about that. These things are really not necessary for our own sadhana, nor for our own growth, other than to marvel. And then also things are told to us as disciples to bolster some inner knowledge we have of our own. So we need to use these things as to how they affect them us, because they're sent to or given to us for a reason. Now, there's lots of reason to have doubts, and there's lots of reasons to have skepticism about all of these things. But it is a funny thing when you're around a great master. The skeptical mind is just simply not there. And if you don't have that, if you don't have that lack of skepticism, if you just, and I would say skepticism is the natural human condition, so I'm not putting it down. It's normal. But if you find yourself in a situation where you just don't, you know, for myself with Mother, I just simply didn't have that part of my mind working. It didn't function around her like that. So I just didn't have to think that way. But it was, and that itself was a gift.
I can't help but think of the Bible quotation that I love so much. And it's, I'm sorry, I'm not a Bible person, but Jesus asked the disciple, who do you think I am?
Mm-hmm.
I love that so much.
Who do you say that I am? Yeah.
I am you are the Christ.
The Son of the Living God, yeah.
Oh, I love that so much because that's where it comes from. It comes mm-hmm. from God. You know, I never had any doubt or any question at all, and it's just a gift.
But you see, do you see the reason why I state it or portray it the way that I do? It isn't that I don't want to take credit for it, but that it is simply the presence, being in the presence of a great master. And if you're receptive enough, and again, if it's your master versus somebody else's master, but it is all those things combined. It is a great, great gift, and you recognize it. You can see it for what it is. You know what your mind normally works like.
Yeah.
And you find yourself in Mother's presence, and you just don't even have the, maybe only when looking back on it do you think yourself, any skeptical things, thoughts do come up, but you marvel at what it's like to be in her presence. This is why, and I know we're so afraid of her in that sense, it's the way we talk about her, because we wanted so desperately to please her, for sure. That drives a lot of it. And then secondly, that we were fearful of what she could withdraw. We had so much from her, and we felt it. It's funny. It is literally, as I'm speaking about it now, it's nothing that you can really think about at the time. It isn't. It is only looking back on it afterwards and wondering about the state of being in her presence, what it was, why was it so different?
It's awe, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's literally awe.
It's interesting that in the Bible they talk about the fear of God and
be not afraid.
Be not afraid.
Not afraid.
God always says, don't be afraid.
But in recent times we've said, oh, well, God is a God of love. We're not supposed to be afraid of him. But it's really talking about awe. Say we were fearful of Father. It really was awe.
Mm-hmm. You know, Larry, I know what you mean, but you know, if I had some fear of Mother, it wasn't defined. You know, I wasn't like thinking something she could do to me. It was respect. You know, when I was close to her and with her at her apartment or wherever, I think awe is a good term. I mean, I was just in awe of her, and I just couldn't stand the idea of her being disappointed with me or
right.
And you know, she was. She had such will. I mean, even if she was just standing there having tea with you or sitting there, you know, there was kind of no messing around with her. You know, she was always trying to teach you something or impart something.
She was always
something.
A teacher. She recognized you. Yeah. She was always the guru. Yeah.
And you better be paying attention, you know, and you knew it. You know, nobody had to tell you that. You know, you were in the presence of greatness. Yeah. You could feel it. And like I say, a lot of these things weren't defined. You know, it wasn't like, oh my goodness, I'm in awe of Mother because of this, and this. It was just very much at a gut level. Like I'd never ever been around anybody like that before.
Yeah.
And when I was with her, I felt like I was in the presence of one of the great leaders of the world. You know, I thought to myself, this is what it must be like to be in the presence of a president or a king or a queen. You know, just tremendous personal power.
Mm-hmm.
And I could feel the waves of just literally power coming off of her. Like, I mean, it was like blowing my hair back. I mean, I just had never experienced anything. She was not, nobody had to tell you that she was not a normal, regular human being. You know, she was like nobody you'd ever met. Mm-hmm. Or seen.
But you know, this is familiarity that comes from other lifetimes and from us having dealt with this before. These are things that
I don't
know.
I think
about.
Anybody could feel it. I think a little kid could feel it. I think an animal could feel it.
Some didn't, obviously.
Yeah,
I know. Hard actually was really hard for me to believe. Like you'd bring somebody to church and I'm like looking at them like, have you ever seen anything like this before? And they're like looking at you like they yawn or something. You know, you feel like grabbing them by the lapels going, don't you realize you're in the presence of God? Realize, master.
There are millions of people who can't feel it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
It's true. What I love about this first chapter in the book, The Mystical Crucifixion, is, you know, she does such a really good job of, you know, really giving you that feeling that she had. And, she obviously, you know, just had a tremendous relationship, really close. The fact that Master could take off his shoes and lay down on the, and, you know, he didn't have to be so formal with her. And, you know, it was obvious that he just loved her and she just worshiped him. And, boy, you get that feeling, you know. This isn't formal teachings. This is the human part of it, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it really lets you know that she had very much the same sort of feeling of Master that we had with her.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You'd do anything for him, you know.
And she had that awe and that respect and that you know, all of that she felt for him.
I used to think, you know, when I was young and I was around mother and when I was away from mother, I used to think to myself, you know, I have this big advantage in life. Like she's on my side. It's like you're picking up sides for dodgeball or something. I got mother, you know, I got mother on my team. And I just thought, you know, like my life was blessed from that. Like I really had somebody in my corner that would make sure that nothing went wrong and that things would go right and I would go in good directions. You know, just sort of this underlying assurance that you'd be okay because you had this person. And for a young person, you know, when you're sometimes unsure of your place in the world, that was pretty nice. That was pretty nice assurance.
But you know, it's funny. What's going through my mind right now as you say that is that it's like having Michael Jordan on a basketball game,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. How can you lose?
This is what's different. If Michael Jordan's there, he's going to make all the points. You know, we're going to win, right? But that's not the same thing as what the guru is.
It's like Michael Jordan grabbing you and you're holding the basketball. He holds you up to the hoop.
He wants to make you Michael Jordan. Right. Mother wants to make all of us. This is what the guru is unique about the guru. They want the points being made by everyone on the team eventually. There's no doubt there's greater ones at different times that come along. That's no greater thing. And this is why I know we complain about SRF, but to say there's no gurus in SRF after Master, this is such a misunderstanding and such a real serious error.
Well, you know, you put out that from one of their publications, you know, I don't think it was East West. It was – I'm thinking – I just had it pulled up the other day. And It had the different Yogacharyas that, mm-hmm. that Master made. You know, there's
right. I sent that out. Yeah.
You sent it out and you right. had a red, line, you know, box around them. And I'm thinking, you know, Master made 6 Yogacharyas.
Right.
And the organization like just doesn't even acknowledge that. You know, I mean,
they don't have it in the teachings. I mean, nothing. Yeah.
I mean, Master recognized them as being Yogacharyas.
Yeah.
But the organization doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
they threaten it for sure.
Nothing against Diamata. I think in your thing that you wrote, you know, Bob Raymer thought that she was realized. I don't know if she was or not, but my mother used to refer to her as the secretary. I got the biggest kick out of that. But there's no credit given to these 6 Yogacharyas.
Yeah.
You know, that the Master made.
I think also because he did it just towards the end of his life. And that they weren't part of their daily
and
structure.
And 2 were in Mexico and 1 was in England.
Right. And there's a natural.
Seattle.
And Detroit. Well, I mean, I think, first of all, we all know that the organizations just are threatened by this kind of thing. And it's clear when they said there's no gurus, other gurus in SRF, that's laying down the gauntlet too. This is a power play. And it's too bad because it really isn't, it is what it is. Master did what he did. And for some reason the organization was important to be left alone as it was because he did put the monks together. He put the convent together, the sisters, and, he made all of that. And that was something he did early on. So those are all things he really wanted.
And when you think about that organization, that's what gave Master, and then the organization continued to publish the autobiography of a yogi, which has gone all around the world, changed so many people. And if it had all just gone into just individual masters, it may have just kind of not had that push behind it.
Well, most masters do that kind of thing. I think Master had something he had to push into the world in this way. This is a necessary thing, and it was to be shorn of all competition. It was to be left in the way that it was. So
we have examples of other lines of gurus. A good example is Ramakrishna is still held as a great, great master, even though, you know, Vivekananda came after him and others. I mean, so you can have that great master within a line. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the last.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's no rule.
Right. But in this case, there is a rule, and I think that's the big mistake. It's one thing to say it and to think it. It's another to formulate it into a rule. It's too bad. But Mother was, that was the grounds on the battlegrounds that she was placed upon too. The form of that battleground was formed by all those circumstances, Master, and then all the people. Rajasi passing away right away too, you know.
Right. So it just kind of, the way it came down, it just passed it right into the hands of the managers and the organizer.
Right.
And it also propelled Mother
forward. If you think about it too, I mean, the same happened with Christ, the same happened with Muhammad.
Yeah.
You know, it concretizes it. It gives mm-hmm. you that focus.
Right.
That for millions, that seems to be very, very important.
Yeah, you're right.
To have those rules, to have some structure.
Well, to have that concretized figure mm-hmm. that people can focus on.
St. Francis, too? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know. I mean, these are above
certainly
what
not
we can understand.
For us, but...
The idea that the masters are still in control is something that, you know, Swami Satchitananda taught us, you know.
Surely master wanted it that way or it would be different.
Yeah. That really helped a lot, didn't it? Because we are all struggling with that, and it's just a brilliant thing to say. It puts it right. Because he'd been through it himself. He'd been through very difficult times on these very things, so.
What used to blow me away is, you know, I'd be at service in that little church up in North Seattle and, you know, you'd look around and there'd be like 50 people in there. And, you know, Mother was so powerful that she'd lift you right up out of your chair. You know, you'd literally be so filled with the light of God. You know, you walked out of there about 3 feet off the ground. And I used to think, you know, I used to look at the number of people and the number of followers that Mother had. And then I'd tune into some Sunday service where some great big guy with a Southern accent and a big white belt and white shoes has like a congregation of 8,000 people or something. And I was completely befuddled. I would look at Mother and I would say, why doesn't every single person in the universe, you know, follow this woman? It was
Mother
the
was hard,
utterly
Mother
confusing
was...
what, thing to me.
Peter, what have you come up with for the answer to that?
Well, I mean, the way that we would always explain is there's these different grades in school and there isn't that many people in graduate school. And, you know, that always makes us feel really good. Maybe that's the answer. You know, there's more people in the fourth grade than there is in, you know, graduate school. I guess that would be an explanation. But
I've been thinking about it a little bit differently, which is not so much where we are, but what we're willing to do to get to the end. And that all of us seem to be willing to take, you know, I think about Greg taking me on early hikes and those switchbacks. And I'm like, why can't we just do the short way? I don't want to do the switchbacks. I want to do the short way. And that's some of the times the way I see this path is it's, you know, there's the bhakti and singing God's name and it's a beautiful, slow, smooth path. And we're like, nah, I got to get done.
I was thinking another thing, too, is that the onus is on us completely as individuals.
Right. That's right.
And it's easier if the priest or the minister.
Or Michael Jordan's making all the points while you're sitting around in the field. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Unless you're a control freak like me. And then you want to
but
be
you know, church. Mother was hard on people too. She would not accept some people. They'd come to church, and we think, I wonder why they didn't come back. If you watch the interaction when they hugged her, sometimes you could see why. Mother could choose. She could pull whoever she wanted to, and that person would be locked in, and she wouldn't give it to others. And she would actually push people away.
You know, that's true, Larry. You know, some people I'd bring people, and some people. You know, Mother talked with a great level of intensity. And of course, I love that because to me, that was her intensity to God. You know, no screwing around. You know, you go to God. But I would bring somebody, I'd bring a guest, and they'd perceived as kind of harsh, you know, kind of on the verge of being angry, you know, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then also Mother could, I mean, I have this story that Dave and I always used to tell.
Are you
going to
tell about your friend?
My friend, but you know, it is so true. And she just very sweet to him, but he never came back. And we both, David and I, were saying afterwards, oh, Mother, don't talk about that. Because we knew him well enough to know that that would be the reason, that would push him away, you know.
Was it the sex thing?
That was one thing, yeah, for sure. That was the major thing, probably. She rarely talked about that. And this time she talked about it quite a bit. And I remember there was one other thing too that he was really didn't like. I think suffering is another thing that people.
A lot of people get bothered by the suffering. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole point of this is to get bliss and get ecstasy and get deep into meditation and drift away into the, nobody wants to.
That's kind of my, part of my point of that. Skipping the switchbacks, you know, your thighs are going to burn when you get to the top instead of having a nice, gentle thing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think if you're doing Rom Nom like Papa is, you're not necessarily.
And I don't mean Papa. I don't mean Papa. I mean, you know, I'm not saying
you're not picking up boxes.
Good. I'm saying I'm impatient. And, so I'm throwing all of it at it.
why would you want suffering? You've already got plenty of that already.
Right. In fact, it's supposed to be the way out of suffering. It's often advertised that way, isn't it? That's so true, Bob. No, but it's funny that, you know, David always said Motherhead must have been a tremendous saleswoman because she could talk people into a path like this, because she would also show you the thorns in the rosebush. She wouldn't just talk about the rosebush. So
you talked about the thorns.
I'm willing to suffer for the shortcut. that's what I wondered about.
Mother made it seem so really realizable. You wanted it. And she was warning you, don't get suckered into the happy talk. Not that she was giving happy talk, but rather our minds were translating it into happy talk. Oh, it's just going to all be taken care of. No, you're wrong to think that. It's going to be thorns in this, you know. And you know what does Khalil Gibran say, that this love hides swords in its pinions. You know, this is a fact of life, and it's important to know this. Because I really want you, this mother really wants you to get there. I really want you, and you need to know these things. I don't want you to be shocked and surprised and lose faith, you know, in this project.
But you notice something, Larry, about when Mother talks about the tremendous travails that you go through, and she talks about the pearl of great price, but.
Yeah.
When she talks about everything that she went through, and you know, she'll talk about tough stuff. I've never heard her once say that without at the very end saying, but it was all worth it.
Yeah.
100 times more. And I would have done it, you know, and many more times. It was all nothing compared to what I got.
It was all
after
blended.
Everything she would say that.
It was always blended with, though. It wasn't just to talk about only the suffering. It's just that the suffering always was brought up. She already had sold us on it, but halfway through any talk. You know, she really had, because she was such an example of it herself, and it was such an uplifting talk. And so she would just caution. It was so important to caution us in her own life.
Just preparing you so that when you did go through the hard times, it wasn't such a big shock.
I was thinking, too, that the real appeal was the love we felt as a child. I was just her child. She was my real mother, and that's all that mattered. And I didn't care what she said, you know.
You really, really felt it. Yeah.
And the feelings of upliftment. Love, yes, but also just that elevated. You know, I mean, anybody that's been around David knows how that was.
Yeah.
You could just, in his presence, you were uplifted.
Yeah. And love would pour from his eyes. It really would,
Yeah, and you don't forget that, you know, your heart and your soul never forgets that. And you think, where else can I get this? You know, I can't get it from the neighbor down the street. I can't get it from the people in my own family, you know. I mean, this is a wonderful sense. And then the natural thing is, well, what does that person have?
Right.
What is that? I want what that person has. Whatever they have, I want that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they turn right around and say, and you can have it.
In fact, that I, this is what I want more than anything else. Secondly, it's the only reason we're having this discussion is to raise you. It's my only interest here.
Right.
Now, that's really something else. Mother wasn't there to be just taken, you know, as though she's the belle of the ball all the time. We always treated her that way, but that was not, and she'd be glad to play that role, but that's not what she was about. She was
one
fierce.
Of the things that I love about these masters is their single-mindedness. So, yeah. You know, then as now, there's so many worldly things to get caught up in. You know, people love to get up caught up in political situations and with all the issues we have. And during Mother's time, there were just as many issues and just as many hot topics. And same with David. And they might touch on something, you know, to make an illustration or a point, but they are always right back on God. Always back on God. Yeah. And I love that. Always getting us back on track. You know, like, yes, there's things that happen in the world. And yes, you know, they can be important and they can change things. But this is what's important. God's what's important. And your connection and your devotion to God, that's what's important. And I love that, the way they always got us back on track. Always, always, always.
You know, I had a realization the other morning when I was reading. I'm trying to remember if I was reading Mother or I was reading Master or Papa. Doesn't really matter. They're all. But what I was realizing, like for many years, I thought to myself, why did I not talk to Mother about more spiritual things? I often talked to her about, you know, how it was going with the family, and she, you know, brought back. And I think all that time I wasted. Now, mind you, when I would try to talk sometimes about spiritual things, she would defer, you know, she pushed me to the side.
It wasn't time wasted, Kate. That was time.
No, of course it wasn't. Both what I was realizing from reading this week was, I believe it was, I don't remember what I was reading, but the gist of it was, you have to be in a certain moral stature, and you can't be living a life of sin or a messed up life and then expect to be going to God. There's that basis you have to have before God takes you up. And so even though we were all attracted to Mother, we've got that part going. She wanted to get our lives together. You know, she wanted the families to be working out. She wanted to, you know, all that kind of stuff to be. So that's why she's talking to me about that kind of thing, because until my life gets on track and I stop, you know, doing this or that I wasn't supposed to be doing, you know, then you can start having these spiritual experiences. Now, maybe you're having some of them beforehand, but she's still going to get that basis there, or you'll leave. You'll go off and do whatever. Eventually, you'll get tempted, or you'll do this if you haven't got that strong foundation. And that's so important. And each master that comes, they talk about the kind of moral life you have to live. And that's why it's so important.
Well, one thing that his mother was unique about was this notion that she thought the householder path was the better path to represent to most people. You know, that she felt that was something you needed, that the individual soul couldn't get to the... As she gave the example of Swami Ashokananda, he asked her, he expected her to give him his realization when she was thinking he was going to help her. And she was shocked when God told her that, because she was having trouble understanding what he was asking for. And also that she recognized that he was attracted to her, and he was mystified perhaps about what the marriage state is like. And if anyone perhaps in his life that would have been interested in being married to, it would have been Mother. We don't know these things. I'm just saying this is what's come to my mind, because Mother talks about it in such a way that it's quite clear. She often talked about marriage being important when she talked about him. And she recognized he was missing something fundamental in his own ego structure, strangely enough, that made him unable to go the next to jump.
Somebody to tell him what to do, Larry. I think that's what
<he was.
laughs>
Right.
He just had a complete lack of direction. That was the problem.
Yes.
And personally never lacked from ever since I got married.
Exactly. But how she phrased it was to be loved for yourself. Now that's really quite amazing. I think we have such We have such a creation, important creation of an ego structure as we grow and as children, we grow up. It's such an important thing to bring that forward and have that healthy and working well in this world so that the follow on stages, the things, the, you know, shocks to the system can be withstood. And that Ramakrishna said it in a different way. He said that you live in, when you were married, you live in a fortress. And you, when you are not, you're at the will and the whims of fortunes of the weather and everything else, whereas you're protected. And so he recognized he didn't, you know, he was quite clear in his own life and many other things he said that he didn't think many people were ready for that. You know, they, just because they weren't married doesn't mean, or they were married doesn't mean they were ready for it, but that he recognized it.
I don't think he said married. He said household.
Yeah, well, that's the same thing.
Yeah. The household is the fortress.
Right, right. But I mean, that is
just being out there cast to the four winds.
Right, right. Householders, though, I mean, in his day, that's the thing he refused to do. He was married, but he refused to cohabit with his wife. So, and maybe he saw himself as a householder. I really doubt he did, but it's possible. That's an interesting thought to see what it is. The thing is, a master of his stature can say, I don't, and Yogananda, he didn't have it. He didn't need it. In fact, it would have been probably a short 59 years that he lived. He had a lot to do. He had a lot on his plate, and he recognized that. And he was probably completely without any of his own physical and astral and probably all and causal karma. He probably had none of it. We just don't know, but he was ready for it. And we look at these people and we think that's the necessary pattern. But Matt Papa too said, first of all, if you have to ask me if I should leave my house and go on the road, if you have to ask me and you're not asking God, that by definition means you're not ready. And it's a wonderful teaching to have. He's saying, don't do it. You know, he was forced out of it, not just in pain. He was forced out because he couldn't think about anything but God. Even his daughter couldn't pull it from him. Even his daughter, whom he was completely attached to, formerly.
Are you talking about Papa now?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. They all became part of the family eventually.
Yeah, he had a bigger family than they, and more responsibilities.
Oh, but I mean, even his wife and his daughter came to the
family. Yeah, oh, that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, they all
Isn't
became
that
part
something?
Of the family, yeah. And bathed in love. I mean, that must have been quite a reunion after all those years, you know, to have all that resolved and be sitting at his feet and just feeling that upliftment and love. Quite a delightful story.
Quite an accomplishment, yeah.
Yeah, it was like he had to go on a big adventure to come home. like Homer in the Iliad.
And Bilbo Baggins.
Yes, of course. That goes without saying.
And his two wonderful grandsons who became saints in their own right. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's...
It's a wonderful study that we're doing here. I think this is quite amazing, a topic.
I think Kate really did a wonderful job in these first two chapters, too.
It's like she's had acting training or something.
Oh, yeah, voice inflection. Reading, he was putting it together, but...
No, I meant you were putting it together.
I have to say that this was Larry. I was reading today and thinking, you know, thank you, Larry, for insisting that Master came first in the whole thing. As I said, I'd had this introductory chapter that I was quite happy with. And then Larry said, no, we got to put Master first. And so I had to redo everything, but I felt good after we put it back in there. It was like, ah, yes, this is the way, this is right. But, it was Larry had to push me. It's kind of like when you get something done, you've put a lot of work into it. And then
you don't want to change it. Yeah. Well, that's why you guys are a good team.
That's what she wrote mostly went into the third chapter though. So.
No, it went
third and fourth chapter.
It was all spread out to the whole book, actually. Mm. But yeah, it's it was good. It's good to start because that's where Mother started.
Right. And she's, he really is the foundation. You know,
that sets the stage properly.
Stage, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just wish Larry would have told you that before you wrote it instead of after.
Miller rep for rolling the rocks uphill, you know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I guess it's all part of the process. Yep.
You're very gracious, Kate.
It wasn't a pretty sight sometimes around here. Oh well. Good for the ego.
Well, Larry gives you credit for doing most of the work. He always says that.
You have to realize, too, that David and I have been talking about this book for decades. We really have. It was all the other books were added by David, mostly. The ideas for the other books, David and Kate probably helped him with that, too, because it all kind of came together around that same time. But this particular book was always what we felt was Mother's great gift to mankind.
Great contribution, yeah.
Yeah.
It really was Mother, though.
Oh, yes.
She put it together. I just go into some kind of other space, and she'd take me here and take me there.
What I find so gratifying about this particular book is, you know, the whole time we all knew Mother, she was always talking about, I'm writing my book. And, you know, it was obviously very, very important to her. And, you know, she had a lot to do in this life.
She talked about it a lot, yeah.
She did. And she eventually, you know, left the body with supposedly this book unwritten. Well, now what Kate's telling us and what we have before us is the book got written. So isn't it gratifying to see that? Mm-hmm. You know, Mother, and Kate, if you're following that direction, then Mother, through you, what a blessing.
Yeah.
Wrote the book. Finally wrote the book.
Wow.
Pretty wonderful.
She's involved in all of this stuff.
All done perfectly.
I feel her so strongly. Yeah.
You know, I was reading today, Larry's putting the new book into Kindle form, so I've been reviewing it and getting to Mother's letters at the back of the book. And Mother writes so beautifully. She writes so beautifully. So there's still part of me that wishes she had written her own book.
Well, you got to be her helper, Kate.
Well, she said it. I mean, she said it.
It's pretty, pretty exalted
words.
Position.
It's just not her written words. And that would have been nice to have seen, too. But we'll be bringing more and more of her written words out, you know, of other letters she has and that. So it'll be, you know, there'll be other things coming up. Because she writes beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, one of the most gratifying things in a line of gurus is to see how one uplifted master honors their guru.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think of Mother, I can't help but think of the way David always talked about her.
Yeah.
And referred to her absolute reverence.
Yeah.
Absolute reverence at every turn. You know, one time I was here in our office and David was down here and, boy, you just never knew, you know, when you were in line for a little correction. And, you know, we were talking about Mother's book and her writings that she wanted to get out. And I said, well, you know, in Mother's defense, she was very busy. And David just snapped. He goes, does she need any defense? You know, he was, you know, I didn't mean anything by it. I was actually trying to explain, you know, because she was so busy. But, you know, he was fiercely loyal, and I love that.
Yeah.
Love that. That's what a disciple should be, right?
Yeah. And his understanding of Mother's state was profound.
And Mother, the way she in every talk almost gives credit to her guru. You know, really. And then look at Master in the book. You know, look at the way he talked about Sri Yukteswar.
Yeah.
Oh, a Christ-like figure, you know.
Yeah.
A lion of God.
Yeah.
is what an example for us.
He patterned what we should all look for. We all should look for that. It, you know, it surprised some people. You know, as David said, he was surprised that if he had a guru, it would be a woman, you know, because that just wasn't the way he thought about it at all. But once he was with her, it didn't seem to matter at all. Of course, that was a big surprise to him, only thinking, you know, after the fact.
But, yeah. Well, you know, we think of these gurus as being from India, and gosh, yeah. You know, I've listened to talks and things. I can only understand about every third word. You know, I'm barely following along. And here I ended up getting an American guru that right. was, you know, came from Seattle. And boy, when she spoke, you understood everything. There was no accent. And there was, yeah. you know, when she let you have it or whatever, there was no misinterpretation. You know, she was an easy one to follow. And I always felt so lucky. And the first time I met her, you know, I think I was 19. And I just thought she was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen in my life. He's 73 years old. He was magnificent. Filled the whole room with light. What an impression on young kid, you know? She was all that.
Yeah.
And more.
Well, let's do our closing prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Oh. Oh. Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen.
Amen.